Well, my next guest's new book is called Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. Some light reading on a Tuesday night. Reverend Kenneth Bedell asked the question, is there still hope for equality in America? Bedell's a former senior advisor for the Department of Education in the Obama administration. He spent time working on faith-based initiatives in higher ed on college campuses. Bedell's a former teacher and also a minister in the United Methodist Church. In the new book, he wonders if we need to look at how racism works from a different perspective and recognize that the promises of the civil rights movement may not have been fulfilled. But that doesn't mean it can go unchecked. We just have to come up with a new way to approach racism. Reverend Kenneth Bedell was in town tonight for a discussion at the Hideout, and he is in studio with me right now, Reverend Dr. Bedell. I mean, there's so many different ways to call you, but I appreciate you being here. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Great, thanks.
So why don't we start? I mean, where does this come from? You have a foreword from Jesse Jackson, and you say that it kind of starts at his great speech at the 1988 Democratic National Convention.
Yeah, that was really, for me, a turning point in thinking about what it means to have a society that really works together. Because he used the image in that speech of a patchwork quilt, which he took from telling about his grandmother, who took all different patches and then sewed them together to make something of value. In the book, that becomes the kind of framing reference that everybody has a contribution to make. And it's all the different, if we think about the future of America without race, then it would be a time when all ethnic groups, identity groups would have their patch, and their patch, mm-hmm. without their patch, you couldn't have a quilt. You have to, every patch is critical to making a quilt.
You talk that way and you can understand a little bit of your religious background, because that seems to be a lot of the teachings of religion, of the idea of everyone coming together and everyone having a voice. Racism gets in the way of that and always has, in the way that some believe that there shouldn't be people who have a patch on the quilt.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you mentioned, as you were opening up, to think about racism in another way. And even it's so obvious to us today that equality is a problem and inequality is a problem. But I would argue that language gets in the way of thinking about contributions, as if we're trying to make it so that everybody has equal something. Well, what is it equal? Well, let's not worry about how we figure out defining equal, which we haven't been able to do,
right,
and think about how can we bring the contributions together. And
so in the argument here is that contributions are more important than the idea of searching for equality.
That's what I would argue. One of the things that I think is helpful is to say, okay, what exactly is the definition of the civil rights dream? How exactly do we define that?
Right.
And only if we have a definition, then can we say, well, then we've realized it or we haven't realized it. And what I would propose is that we define it in two ways. The first thing is that we say what we've just been talking about, that every group has full participation. And so, and that's easy enough to look around. You can look around at the United States Congress and say, well, is everyone participating here? Does it look like we've got full participation in our political process? Or is it primarily a group of old white men that make up the Congress? So now if you talked about equality, you'd have to say, well, doesn't everyone have an equal opportunity to be a congressperson?
So contributions and participation is really a better sort of way to look at in reality, as opposed to what could be when you talk about equality.
Exactly. And I would say there's a second part to it, because that has to do with groups. But the second part that I'd argue is that we need to not think about equality for individuals, but think about how we can make it so no individual has more barriers to achieving their personal aspirations than any other person. And so think of it from the side of reducing barriers rather than making things equal. And then we can see if there are barriers that keep minorities from full participation as individuals.
It strikes me too, because you think about from that speech, that specific speech from Martin Luther King, the I Have a Dream speech.
Mm-hmm.
and you think about the civil rights movement. And it all kind of comes from the same place in this idea of a search for equality and all the terms that are used. If, I mean, really, you think of, you can make an argument to say that has moved our country in the idea was right, but the terminology and the concepts were wrong, and it's why in 2017 we haven't been able to solve this issue.
Yeah, that's what I would argue, and that while it was really important because what King did in the Dream speech was say, this just isn't working. That was basically, and we're not going to put up with it anymore. That was the thing that he said. What I like about Jesse Jackson's 1988 speech is that he proposed a vision for what it could look like if everyone was part of that future.
Even in the book, I mean, the you talk about diagnosing and treating American racism, realizing the civil rights dream. How do you find solutions in this day and age, in 2017? How do you say to people who have been systemically oppressed or in a position where they feel like their inequality is a big part of their life, that doesn't matter? That part doesn't matter. You know, we're going to reset the button and we're going to try again. How do you do that in a way that everyone would say, yeah, I think it's all going to work out this time?
Yeah. Well, that certainly is the important question. And I hope that my book is able to help contribute to that conversation. I'd argue that there have been, since the 1960s, some really important new understandings about sociology and social psychology and the way that societies function that Dr. King couldn't have possibly known about because much of that theory wasn't developed. There are a number of strands, but we can kind of summarize three quickly. One is that institutional racism is really two kinds of institutional racism. There's the institutional racism that isn't essential for the workings of the institution. It's part of what happens, and it may be that minorities aren't hired in the same way, or that people who went to an HBCU aren't given the same opportunities that someone that went to an Ivy League or whatever. Those right, kinds right. of things, but it doesn't really impact the institution. So that kind of institutional racism, we just need to become aware of, sensitive to, and work on. There's another kind of institutional racism that one of the places that I think we've become really aware of it is in the work that's been done in the New Jim Crow. And looking at the way that the prison system and the
yeah,
criminal
right.
justice system, but those
Someone
are
who's profiting off of segregation and racism,
and actually institutionalizing a structure that creates racism within the society. And one of the things that social psychologists and sociologists have figured out, there's a Frenchman, Foucault's his name, who looked at these disciplinary institutions that are where their purpose is to change people and to make sure that the racism is supported. Schools can be that, not all schools, but schools can be that way if they're designed to deny people their full participation in their own ethnic group, for example.
Kenneth Bedell is my guest, a reverend doctor and former teacher, minister in the United Methodist Church, former senior advisor in the Department of Education for the Obama administration. His book is called Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. That's what we're talking about tonight. I really truly believe that there are connections and pathways and parallels to your work in faith-based initiatives and the idea of what you're doing in the Obama administration to have different religions talk to each other, understand each other. It seems like one of the pathways that could be used would be the church to sort of decide on a new way and a new course to sort of find solutions for racism. Mm-hmm. Kenneth Bedell, my guest, let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk about that part of the equation here on The Download. Stay with us. We're well on our way tonight to solving racism with our guest, Reverend Kenneth Bedell. He's a senior advisor in the Department of Education, the Obama administration. Spent time working on faith-based initiatives on college campuses. The book is called Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. Reverend Bedell was in town tonight for a reading at the Hideout. He just came right to the studio from there. I'm fascinated with your work, like I mentioned, it, with religion, because it feels to me like there's parallels there. If religions took center stage and said, we're going to be the ones, and whether it be in the church or the synagogue or any other place, the mosque, where we said, hey, we're going to tackle this issue of racism together. We're going to help understand how other people are approaching this, but also what other people are better understand where they're coming from. Religion does play a big part in sort of stereotypes.
Yeah, Justin, I think that's a really important point. And I was privileged, as you mentioned, to work on the President's Interfaith and Community Service Campus Challenge. It was President Obama who actually had what I think was just a brilliant insight. That was that if you want to get Jews and Muslims and Christians and Hindus to talk with each other, that the way to do it is not to start out and say, okay, what do you think about God? But to get them to work together on a community service project. And so he called it the Interfaith and Community Service Campus Challenge.
And the goal was to have people understand each other from different religious backgrounds without talking religion.
But well, that they'd start out and they'd go and do a project. And they'd work on something right here in Chicago. Trinity Christian College did a project with a mosque where they cleaned up a trail. Well, then they'd go back to campus, and the people from the mosque would sit with the people from Trinity Christian College, and the conversation was about why do they value doing that for the community? What came out of that? Well, then that took them to the place of where they were able to talk to each other because they already had a place of commonality to stand on.
I would assume a lot of this starts at the college campuses where there is this identity, especially when you're trying to figure out who you are and how you're going to contribute to society, that religion plays a big part, your background, who you were. You're not necessarily open to hearing the other person's point of view, a different religion's point of view, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and one of the things that we discovered was that across the country, there were people on college campuses that were staff, or maybe there were even several chaplains that really kind of wanted to have that happen, what you're describing. Yeah. And that then when the President of the United States says, well, I challenge you to have some programs or to increase programs on your campus where people of different faiths are going to start out working together and then also have a component of sharing then about what that means to them. And it just kind of blossomed. It was like it was the right thing for the right time. And I think sometimes these administrators, they'd be able to go then to their dean or to their president and say, look, let's be part of something. This is a national program.
From that experience and the experience of being a part of that interfaith movement and challenge at universities and colleges across the country, how has that informed the work you're doing now with the civil rights book that you just put out? The idea that we need to redefine and recategorize or at least rethink what racism is.
Yeah.
Is it the same concept at the end of the day that we need people to who may have, and I don't want to say are racist because, that's not what I mean, but the idea that to better understand each other, we need to find common ground.
Yeah, and I think it's helpful, like when you kind of started to say, well, what's racist, to realize that I think everybody is kind of in a soup of racism, and everybody participates often unintentionally in racist activities and are participants in things. And so that it's helpful to think about racist activities rather than racist people. Now, there are some people who claim to be racist, and then you can allow that. I mean, they say that's what they are and let them.
And wear it as a badge, right?
Yeah. But for the rest of us, we need to focus on what is the activity. And that's where the place is really important, I think, in the conversation that you're talking about, to work on how do we engage and think about what it means to get in the other person's moccasins, or to, you know, how would I like other people to think about me, or how would I feel if people were saying
it's
that?
It's amazing, and I talked about this with Eve Ewing in the last segment as well, but I mean, there really is what we seem to be losing in this country is this an understanding of the people that we're having arguments with. Empathy, just the idea of where people are coming from, or who these people are, or what, you know, it always boils down to a conservative liberal political fight, but we see more often religion plays a big role, race plays a big role. At a certain point, we have to find ways that we all can talk to each other before we talk to each other.
Yeah. And I got a friend who explained to me how important it is to have the he called it the family talk. So the place where you can talk about, well, who are we as a people? What's important about our family? How are we special? And then you have your public conversation and the way that you share things. And without that private conversation, which I think kind of the formation, the way we've kind of form ourselves, then without that, we're not ready to engage with others with a kind of integrity. And I think going back to what I was saying about college campuses, that's another place where it's easier for college students to begin with the thing that they know. Wow, I think it's so important to preserve the environment, or to build houses for the poor, or to help with a food bank. They can start with identifying that, and then realize, hey, this is who I am. This is my faith, and then they can talk to other people.
You know, the subtitle of the book is Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. As you diagnose it, and you see that really we just need to figure out how to classify it in a better way. How do you treat it? I mean, once we get to a certain point where people are talking and they say, okay, I can understand, I do want to contribute. How do you keep it from what seems to, in this conversation we've had, to be a normal human trait, right? Yeah. How do you keep it from spoiling a new system?
That's a complicated question, but I'd
so
like
we
to,
only have 2 minutes left.
Oh,
so.
2 minutes. Okay. So I'll throw out one thing, and that is, I think when we think about our, we have certain things that we just sort of understand. Like, we have a sense of humor. Different people have a different sense of humor, and even different cultures have different senses of humor. But there's also a sense of racism. And one of the things that we can do in terms of the treatment is to really take seriously with each other developing our sense of racism. When we see racism, to point it out to each other, to take seriously helping each other come to make it and so that it's part of our sense, so we don't just make excuses for what happens, but we really can see where that is. And a big part of that is listening across racial groups and ethnic groups. And when someone says, well, you know, that was a racist thing, not to say, oh, no, they were just having a bad day, or, you know, the bus driver wasn't really being racist. No, it may have been right to really be able to see where bus drivers are racist at times. So there may be a racist activity that evolves.
And that would be a way that we would change it in society, especially if you took away the heft. You know, if you're called out for racist activities, That's a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. That could be a life change for you. But if in a different situation you were called out, it still was important and still serious, but it wasn't this sort of like, you know, everybody get the bus driver.
Yeah.
You know,
it
would be a way that we could move forward and get past these things that keep tripping us up.
Yeah. I think that's a really important part of the treatment. Another part of the treatment is to go ahead and get involved in things like judicial reform. It's just to not make a pun, but it's criminal. The current justice system.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because that came up with Eve's conversation as well. Reverend Kenneth Bedell. Senior advisor for the Department of Education during the Obama administration, spent time working in faith-based initiatives in higher ed and college campuses, the Interfaith Challenge that we just talked about. Former teacher, also a minister in the United Methodist Church. His new book is called Realizing the Civil Rights Dream, Diagnosing and Treating American Racism. A light little conversation on Tuesday.
Good.
Reverend Bedell, a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.